Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, tough boss, temperamental manager, inexperienced or less than competent co-workers, we have two guests to the rescue today. A happy work life makes for a happier life overall, and tackling workplace conflict with wisdom and grace may seem a little challenging in the moment, but it is possible. Today, we're launching a summer series at 9 and 11 about work. So more conversations to come. And if you want to suggest a show about work, tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. As our guests join us today, we'd love to hear your questions. Are you struggling to communicate with your manager? Are you on a team where not everyone is pulling their weight? Are you trying to figure out what your next career move is, or maybe what your first career move is? Talk to us today about your work life. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and again on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Allison Green, writes the Ask a Manager column for The Cut, and she joins us today from Washington, D.C. And Allison, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Walker is with us. He writes the Workologist column for the New York Times, and he's in New Orleans today. Rob, really good to talk to you again. Welcome back.
Hi, Carrie. Nice to be back. And Allison, I'm honored to share the air with you.
Likewise.
Allison, I want to go right to the career conundrum because it's graduation time. New graduates are saying, how in the heck do I start a career that I'm going to love? Mid-career people, I think, all too often say, oh, this started off with such promise. It hasn't really fulfilled what I thought it was going to be. You probably hear from a lot of readers that are in these situations. What do you say?
Yeah, I think people look to work as a source of fulfillment, perhaps more than they should. Our culture has a narrative that we sell to people that work should always be fulfilling, and that if it's not, you have somehow failed professionally. And I don't think that's true. I think there's a lot of liberation in the idea that work doesn't have to be always a source of emotional satisfaction. It's great if it is, but it doesn't have to be. And you're not a failure if it's not.
Allison, I mean, you spend so much of your time at work. It's really tied up in our identities, who we think we are. Yes, I'm surprised to hear you say, not a big deal if your work isn't so fulfilling. What's the deal with this?
I think the vast majority of the world's population does not work for emotional fulfillment. They work for money because they have to. And those of us who have jobs that we really enjoy are the very, very lucky minority. That's not to say that you shouldn't seek out work that you enjoy and that you do get fulfillment from. But if you find yourself in a position mid-career or early career where things aren't going quite the way you would have liked, that's okay. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try to work to change that if there's a path that you know you'd like to follow. But so many people who write to me are really frustrated because they feel like they've failed at this thing they were told work was supposed to be. And it just doesn't need to be. I mean, if you're reasonably content at what you're doing and you do it reasonably well, that's pretty good.
Rob, I am one of those people that just expect a lot of fulfillment from my job. And luckily, I get it. I think it's something we should want. I'm interested in how you think about Allison's advice here.
Oh, well, I mean, this does come up a lot. And I think here's what I would say is that, you know, there are enough real problems with work without inventing the problem of like, oh, my gosh, I'm not having a fulfilling enough time here. And I just, you know, I'm not measuring up to the incredible satisfaction that I sort of, you know, that the culture sort of tells me I should be getting, and maybe I should just chuck it all. And this is the letter that I get the most often is, you know, should I just chuck it all and do this completely other thing and follow my bliss or whatever? And, you know, maybe, but sometimes it can help to just try to think about making what small change could you make in the workplace, you know, that would just make your day to day a little bit better.
Well,
and that would help you maybe appreciate what you've got.
Give me an example of that. Does something come to mind?
Well, maybe there's something that, you know, there's some duty that you have that you like more than other duties, but you don't do it quite as much. And maybe you can get your manager to shift to where you're focusing more on that particular thing rather than, you know, rather than something else. Or maybe it means working with a particular team member more often or, you know, or changing your schedule in some way or just something that's kind of more attainable and that can be positioned as good for the business that will make your day-to-day life better and that doesn't involve this kind of angst of, you know, am I fulfilling my potential as a human being? Because there are many other ways to fulfill your potential as a human being. True. I'm like you. For me, work is a big part of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, for some people, it's just not. You know, have a hobby. They have a child. They have other things that they can. And like I said, there's enough problems in the workplace. That you don't need to invent more.
Call here from Doug in Moose Lake. Hi, Doug. Question
yeah,
about your work life. Hey.
Yeah, I guess I would love to find out exactly how they would handle a situation like mine, where I love what I do. I mean, I just finally got into the field of, you know, doing purchases and stuff like that. And in my case, it's a little bit weird because I work right next to the owner's son, who is very qualified to be able to do the job. But it's just, you can definitely tell he gets a lot of extra perks. We're only supposed to take like a half hour lunch, and there are days where my lunch breaks are only 5 minutes long because he decides he wants to take off for an hour, hour and a half.
So what do you do when you're working alongside somebody who's got some privileges that you don't? Allison, step in.
I think in a case like that where maybe it's not a family business, but to some extent it sounds like a family business, that comes with the territory. That, I mean, part of the reason that people have their own businesses is in some cases that they want to be able to provide jobs to family members. So that is part of the deal in many cases if you're working for that kind of business. But it's natural, I think, to feel a little irked by it, maybe resentful. One thing to keep in mind is that that coworker is probably building a very different kind of reputation for himself than the caller is. Uh-huh. At some point, if he does want to move on to another job, he might not have the kind of stellar, glowing reputation that's going to make that really easy.
Rob, would you concur with that? Just reset your expectations and know that maybe within the company, your value is noticed and his isn't?
Yeah, and I would agree with that, and I would just add to it that when this kind of thing comes up, the thing you have to focus on is not just what's irritating, but what's an actual problem, and try to distinguish between those things, and figure out like, well, what is going on, what privileges is this guy getting, or whatever, that are impacting you negatively, or that are more important, maybe impacting the business negatively. Because if you want something to change, you're always going to be better off making an argument to management that's about why this change is good for the business rather than why this change will make your life less full of irritation. And yes, as Allison said, particularly if you're going to pick that fight with the boss's son, you're just going to lose. So you need to have a reason that you need to have specific things you want and specific reasons for why they should happen.
Here's a beer on Twitter who says, I've had great conversations with my coworkers and boss about this, but I know it needs to be discussed more widely. What's the norm for workplace boundaries and is it changing? How do coworkers interact to be friends but also keep professional boundaries, especially with social media? Rob, I know you've dealt with this with people that have written in for the column. What do you say about these workplace friendships, how much to share, and how social media influences that?
Yeah, opinions vary widely on this, I don't know that there's a right answer that cuts across everything, that you kind of have to go by the workplace. I try to tell people, you know, to maybe lower their expectations in terms of the importance of being pals with everyone that they work with, that really you just need to peacefully coexist. You don't really need to make workplace friendships, because I think that urge to be close to people is what leads to problems. And especially when you get into the social media realm, like just don't friend all your coworkers on Facebook or what, just don't. I would say just don't do it. You know, sometimes there's cultural pressure to do that, but it just leads to more problems. And I just tend to tell people to err on the side of caution.
Do you feel, Rob, that it is acceptable to, even if the friendship is somewhat casual in the workplace, give details about your love life or, you know, other somewhat personal details? Should you be wary of that, or is that okay?
Again, there's a sort of like different people have different things. I would say be very cautious about it. And if you want to keep your personal life out of the workplace in general, keep it completely out. I would assume I'm dealing with this with a question right now about office gossip and where the lines are and all this kind of stuff. People have very different opinions, but I would say if there's something that you don't want any of your coworkers to know, then don't tell any of your coworkers.
Allison, office gossip, what's your recommendation on that? Or even just exchanging confidences among workplace colleagues?
Yeah, I emphatically second everything Rob just said. I think it's really tricky because I think workplaces have had a tendency to become less formal in recent years, and it makes the boundaries a little bit harder to navigate. Probably 50% at least of the letters that I get at Ask a Manager are from people who are navigating different sorts of boundary issues. I think the top letter on my site right now is from someone whose coworkers are pressuring her to share details about her medical disability, and she doesn't want to share them.
Jeez.
So I think the other side of this, in addition to how much is appropriate for you to share, is be really careful about how you may inadvertently be pressuring other people to share. It's easy to cross that line and become nosy and intrusive about people's reproductive plans or their health or their relationship status and kind of assume, oh, well, these are friendships and everyone's comfortable talking about that. But not everyone looks at their work relationships that way.
This is a summer series on work. You'll hear shows about it at 9 and 11. I'd love to have you suggest a show. If you have a conundrum at work or you have a big, I don't know, philosophical question about work, tweet it at me and we'll add it to the list of shows that we're talking about for our work series. It's at Carrie NPR. In the meantime, Allison Green is with us. She writes the Ask a Manager column for The Cut. And Rob Walker is with us from the Workologist column for The New York Times. And I'm inviting you to tell us a bit about your workplace dilemmas, the dramas at work, or some of those big questions like, how do I get into a career that is going to be lucrative and I love? I'm starting out. I don't know where to begin. How do I look? And then just some of the interpersonal stuff that it sounds like Rob and Allison really hear from a lot of readers about. What are you navigating at work? How are you dealing with some of these interpersonal difficulties? Do you have a question about how to ask for a raise? I've got to get to this because I hear from this from friends a lot. So I want to get Allison and Rob's thoughts on that. 651-227-6000 for your questions. 800-242-2828 to Chris in St. Paul. Hey, Chris, what's your question?
Yeah, hi. I guess my question would be, what could I do to make this a better place to work? But I've been in this place for about over 13 years now, and it's extremely toxic. It's a union situation. Everything I do gets sabotaged, and I pretty much have to wait out my career until I can retire and hopefully go somewhere else and get my career back. But
wow, Chris, this sounds tough. So how many more years do you think you have at the place?
Well, for maximum retirement, it'd be about almost 6 years.
Okay. Yeah, so you're gritting your teeth and looking ahead. Allison, how to make that situation better?
Yeah, I think sometimes you've got to really keep in mind why you're making the choices that you're making, why you're choosing to stay there in a situation that you might not be loving. What are you getting in exchange for doing that? Maybe it's retirement benefits. Maybe it's a great commute. Maybe it's the salary. Maybe it's not having the hassle of having to find another job right now. There's some reason why you're choosing to be there. And sometimes remembering that can give you a feeling of control back.
Yeah, Rob, it sounds like you have something to add.
Just to amplify that, I mean, another thing that I tell people who are in this kind of situation, because it does come up, is kind of what Allison's saying is like, but just check your options. Don't make the decision final that you're just going to wait out those 6 years. If you really feel like it's toxic, yeah, I had someone tell me once that those 6 years will feel like 12 years and, you know, it's not going to get any better. And even the process of considering your other options, you know, looking, maybe not actively looking for another job, but seeing what else is out there could help shift your perspective and at least maybe take your mind off of, you know, just this endless grind that you seem to be in.
Is there any way?
Give you some hope.
Yeah, Rob, is there any way to take this to a supervisor or a boss? even while you're talking perhaps about some specific solutions that that Chris thinks might improve the situation? Or is that just, I don't know, is that not going to really reap any rewards there?
Yeah, it's going to depend on the workplace and on the individuals involved. And I mean, you can't just go to the boss and say, this place is toxic. you're not going to really get anywhere. But if you can go, to echo something from earlier, if you can have some small doable suggestions that are tangible and could actually happen and benefit, and you can make a case that it will benefit the business, then you may get, you may make a little headway if you have a sympathetic manager you can go to. And maybe the satisfaction from just even a small change will help ease the passage through this journey to retirement.
Allison, you wrote a column in February about how to work for a bad boss. And I was interested, how would you define what a bad boss is? I know them when we see them, but is there an overall standard that you'd say you're working for a pretty bad person if you're working for someone who does that?
There's so many different ways that that can present itself. It can be anything from unrealistic expectations to completely unclear or contradictory expectations, someone who never gives you feedback, someone who only gives you critical feedback, someone who doesn't give you critical feedback that you need to succeed, someone who's unreasonable, someone who treats you like a child. I could go on and on. There are a lot of different ways that that can manifest.
And so how do you survive that?
A few things. One is the point that I made earlier, that sometimes you have chosen to be there and accept those trade-offs for good reason. Maybe you put in 2 years there and it's prestigious enough that it's going to open doors for you somewhere else that you want to go. Maybe it's a very generous salary. Maybe you have a very unstable work history and you're looking to change that. And so you want to get in a good couple of years there. Sometimes there's reasons that make sense to be there. Other times you might look at it and think, maybe there's not. But sometimes you can look around and think, oh, this will never change. And that's very frustrating and demoralizing.
Right.
But sometimes when people think that, it's not necessarily true. It's very easy with a difficult boss to think, oh, I don't want to have a conversation with this person about these issues. She's difficult to deal with. I'm intimidated by her, whatever it might be. But sometimes, not always, sometimes you can have a conversation about the issues that are bothering you. If it's something very broad, like a toxic culture, that's going to be pretty difficult to change. But if it's something more narrowly defined, like an unrealistic workload, or you signed up to do one thing and most of what you're doing is something else that you don't enjoy at all, those sorts of issues can be resolvable, but you have to speak up about them because your boss won't necessarily know that you're unhappy unless you do.
You know, Rob, I find one of the things that's valuable in that is reiterating, if you feel it, your commitment to the work and the company. Still saying, I want to be as invested. I want to bring my best self to the work. I want to do the best work I can. Here are some of the things that might be getting in the way of that. Many supervisors are pretty sympathetic to that, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the right mindset to be in. And like I said before, it's a much more effective mindset than I'm unhappy, make me happy,
Yeah.
But Allison's right that it is possible to make changes happen, but you do have to, you have to decide that there is that possibility, and you do have to do something. You have to take that action. You have to have that conversation. I think what people are often looking for is like, how do I make this change happen without me actually ever being uncomfortable?
Exactly.
Exactly
right.
And there is no way to do that. You have to suck it up and figure out a way to make your case and try. Maybe you'll fail and the manager won't change and they're just inflexible. But the odds of them randomly changing on their own without you saying anything are zero. So you'd have a better chance than that.
Vicky in on the Iron Range. Hey, Vicky. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Question.
Sure. Well, I was just listening earlier about, you were talking about emotional fulfillment with your job.
Right.
And a few years ago, I was having a lot of problems at work. I work in a small office that's very high pressure. And I realized that I had problems with my boss, and I realized that the reason why I was reacting to him the way I did was because of emotional traumas, like through childhood, and I had a problem with men in positions of authority.
Uh-huh.
So I think a lot of times the way we react to our coworkers and we react to our bosses can have a lot to do with going back in your life. And I was able to have that conversation with my boss after I did get some therapy. And I was able to have that conversation with him, and I was able to change my work hours so I'm there an hour earlier before anyone else just to get started on the day.
Really good point here. I mean, looking at it, the dynamic of both of you, not just he or she makes me feel like this. It's also, Allison, why do I react the way I do to that boss's persona?
Yeah, I think we bring a lot of emotional stuff to work that isn't necessarily about work or our coworkers or the job. It's about deep-rooted personality traits that might go really far back and have nothing to do with any of those things. And it can be really helpful to take a step back and look at, what am I bringing to this? Is there a way that I could be approaching this differently that might be getting me much better results and the outcome that I want?
I think it's rewarding to use psychology on bosses, don't you, Allison? You feel like you've kind of won and they don't even know why.
It's true. And really, I mean, what you want in all of these interactions is not to be right or to make a point. Well, maybe we want that, but it's not the real outcome that we're going for. You want something to change that's going to make your life at work better. And I think a lot of times people's impulse is to make the big speech and really have it out and say the thing that's on their mind. And sometimes that's warranted, but more often than not, if you step back and you are more calm and more objective, you're more likely to get the outcome you want.
Allison Green is with us. If you've just gotten in on the show, we're beginning a work series. She writes the Ask the Manager column for The Cut, and Rob Walker is with us, the workologist, and he writes for The New York Times. I say we're starting a series here. Yeah, like every Tuesday, Wednesday through June and July, we want to examine work issues. Some of the interpersonal dynamic stuff, some of the big questions about how to launch a career and the stuff that we started talking about at the beginning here about satisfaction in work and some of the other big philosophical stuff. So feel free to suggest a show at CarrieNPR on Twitter, and feel free to call in now, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Elise says on Twitter, Rob, there's no possibility of upward mobility in my job. I want to get a new job, but I never feel I have enough of the experience or the knowledge for many of the job descriptions that I read. How much of the advertised job experience and knowledge do I actually need to have?
Well, that will vary. I mean, you know, what you have going for you right now is a pretty tight labor market. So, one way to explore that is to give it a shot to some of these things and see how the interviews go, see what kind of try to get a sense of where are your weaknesses in terms of what the kinds of jobs you're seeking are actually looking for. And then maybe there's just one key thing that you can work on in the short term that will help you get over that hump. I've said before, I'm sort of a fan of thinking of looking for new work as a sort of a full-time occupation rather than something to turn into a once every 5 years event or whatever. Just explore, see what's out there. And like I said, now's a good time to do that because there's a lot of hiring going on.
Rob, explain your philosophy about that, the continual look for work. Why?
Because I think that people box themselves into this situation where they wait until there's an absolute crisis and they just have to get out of a job.
Right.
And that's the worst mindset you can be in when you're job hunting, because that you're almost guaranteed to sort of settle for something that's not as good as what you could have done, and that may end up actually being worse because you're in a mindset of escape rather than progress. So I don't mean literally devote every weekend to sending your resume out all the time. I just mean always be aware of what's out there. If someone invites you to lunch, go. If you have an opportunity to, you know, hear more about a job, even if you love your job, but you have an opportunity to hear about something else, what do you have to lose? And that way you're making connections. And when the time comes that you really need to make a change, you won't be completely starting from scratch.
I'm hearing from a number of you about intergenerational workplaces. I think that would be a great topic for a show. So I'll put it on the list. To the phones to Larry in Minneapolis. Hey, Larry. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to encourage people to keep an open mind as they're looking. I was in the nonprofit world for a long time and liked most of that, but toward the end had a management structure that was pretty micromanaging and ended up taking an opportunity in the corporate world where I actually have a management structure that's much more supportive than I actually had there, which seemed kind of counterintuitive to me that the smaller nonprofit would have been kind of more like a family operation. So, you know, just you just never know.
So you were thinking, oh, I'm going into the mean, cold corporate world. I'm not going to like this as much. And you found out you did.
Right.
Okay. Good to have a call. Thanks very much. Here's Chris who says, I took on a project on a volunteer basis last year, and now the project has grown and there's no timeline for this to end. And my responsibility has grown three times. How do I ask for a raise or a promotion? Allison, what should he do in that situation?
Yeah, he's really well positioned to make that request. I think a lot of times people ask for a raise or a promotion based on something they will do in the future, and it can be much more compelling if it's based on what you already have done. So yeah, sit down with your boss, lay it out. Here's what I've done. I took this on as a volunteer project. It's tripled in size. Here's what I've achieved. Can we talk about increasing my salary or my title to recognize the work that I've done?
Good. To Chris in Port Wing, is that right, Chris?
Port Wing, Wisconsin, yes.
Oh, I didn't even know
Lake
where that
Superior.
Is. Good to have your call. What are you thinking about?
The first raise my son got, he went to the office manager and asked her if she had a copy of his resume. The next morning, he got $1 an hour raise.
What does that mean? I mean, what are you really saying there?
Well, he was, you know, new to, in the workplace, so he was afraid to come and ask for it. So he thought, well, if he made them think that he was looking for another job, so he said, you know, just asked her politely, do you have my resume on file?
Wow.
Could you make me a copy?
Interesting. Rob?
And he got a raise the next day.
What do you think of that tactic, Rob?
I think that one may be a one-off. I don't know.
right.
I don't know how often that would work. But, you know, I mean, it does get at something, which is that obviously one way to concentrate your employer's attention is to have other options, or I guess in this case just imply that you're thinking of something.
But you
else.
Better have other options, right? If you're going to use that or no?
Yeah, I mean, I think so that was it's an interesting tactic and very low key that he had nothing to lose by doing that. It rarely goes quite that easily, but. You know, as a serious thing, one of the things that you want to do when you're going to prepare for if you're going to ask for a raise is to sort of do the research about why you deserve it as compared to not just what you think, but what the marketplace thinks. And that does sometimes involve, you know, actually scoping out what other jobs are available to someone like you.
Allison, best advice on asking for a raise and why do so many people sweat it, do you think?
It's really nerve-wracking. We don't like talking about money as a culture, and people are really afraid that they're going to hear no if they ask for a raise. Although, if you do hear no, ask what it would take to get a raise in the future and what that timeline might look like, because that will give you really good data. You might get information that tells you, I'm not likely to get a raise here anytime soon. And then you know that you'll need to start looking around elsewhere if you do want to increase what you're making. But I think the big thing to know about asking for a raise is people often picture it needing to be this big presentation that they'll make, and they'll have a bullet-pointed list that they'll go down and maybe some slides. You don't have to do that. You can sit down with your manager. You can say, I feel like I'm contributing at a significantly higher level than the last time we set my salary a year ago. Here's a couple of quick things that I've done since then. Can we adjust my salary? That's it. It does not need to be a big, intimidating presentation.
I think part of the thing that people dread about asking for a raise too, Allison, is they think this is going to be the moment when they hear how their work is valued, and there may be a gap between the way your manager perceives the value of your work and you perceive. And that's tough, no matter what. I don't know that that necessarily happens, but I think there's a perception that that's what's going to unfold.
Yeah, what we're paid is very personal, and it's supposed to reflect our worth to our employer. It doesn't always do that, but it certainly feels like it's supposed to. And it can be tough to feel like you've been working really hard. Maybe you've been getting better results than ever before, or better than your coworkers. And if that's not recognized with the currency that we use to recognize that at work, which is money, that can be a real punch in the gut.
Rob, when's the last time you asked for a raise, and how did it go?
Well, as a freelancer, it doesn't exactly work that way. But oh. I mean, I can't actually remember the last time I asked for a raise. But to add to what Allison is saying, it is nerve-wracking for people to do this. I know people have a tough time with these conversations. But you're not going to like, it's pretty rare that unless there's something set up really specific within your company, your boss isn't going to – I mean, it's to your boss's advantage to continue paying – if you're doing great work at the current salary, your boss doesn't have much incentive to make a change. And one of the things I tell people about trying to get over the – I agree with what Allison says, that you don't have to make a big presentation. But sometimes it helps to kind of have like practice conversation with your spouse or a good friend to sort of just get comfortable talking through, here are the basics of my argument. How does it sound? Just so that it sort of sounds familiar coming out of your mouth and it doesn't seem like such an intimidating procedure that's going to, be this big showdown that's going to define the rest of your life. It's because it's really not. And if you can get comfortable with it, it'll go a lot easier.
Call here from Ali in Apple Valley. Hi, Ali. What are you dealing with?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
But I got a question. How are you going to convince me and explain to your managers who does not care about, family and your health issue, when you already know he does not prioritize to his family, because one day his dad passed away and he being gone only 3 hours and he show up next hour? So how are you going to explain that manager, and where are you going to start the conversation?
Rob?
Well, if you can position it, I'm not sure what exactly you're asking for per se, but the way to think about it is to try to get into the mindset of that boss, try to figure out what it is you want, and get in the mindset of that boss in terms of, his relationship to the business, if he's not a family-oriented person, and how you can make your argument in a way where it feels like it's to his advantage and to the business's advantage for you to get whatever it is that you want, that, that being able to take time off to do something will make you more efficient and pay off in this other way. You just have to kind of, recognize not just the sort of weaknesses of your manager's thought process, but the biases of his thought process, so that you can exploit them to your own end.
Yeah, Allison, I guess I might also raise the idea that, yes, on the face of it, it looks like maybe your boss is not as family oriented as you are when they take 3 hours off for the death in a family, but maybe being wary of drawing conclusions about that too.
That's true, especially if the boss is the business owner. That can be a very time-intensive job. I would like to think that you can get more than 3 hours off for the death of a family member, but people are different in the way that they approach work, and it can be really tempting to draw conclusions from the way you see your boss operating and extrapolate to think they want you to operate that way too. And sometimes it does mean that, but not always. I'm thinking about a time years ago when I was managing a team, and I like to work weird hours. I answer emails in the middle of the night, so my team would get emails from me at like 2 a.m. And I realized pretty quickly, they think that they're supposed to be answering these or that they're supposed to keep these hours too. And I had to be very clear and explicit with people that that wasn't what I expected. So sometimes your boss is modeling the behavior that they expect from you, but not always.
Allison runs the askamanager.org website, right, Allison? Is that where the best place to get some questions answered from you?
Yeah, I run askamanager.org, which is just tons of questions every day about life at work.
Okay. And Rob, best way to get some questions answered from you is what? Just write into the column?
Yeah, workologist at nytimes.com.
Okay, good. All right. So I want to talk about tough but fair criticism and how to take that. And Allison, you've written about clear communication. What? Talk a little bit about the helpful self-talk, I guess is how I think of it, when you've gotten a critique that is wounding but wasn't necessarily meant to be and might in the end be constructive. So how do you work through this yourself when you've been in this position?
A few things are really key, I think. One is, even if you just profoundly disagree with that feedback, you have still learned something really important from it. You've learned that this is how you are being perceived. And that matters. That means that if you do disagree with it, you need to figure out why this other person has this mistaken impression and what you need to do about that. The other thing to remember, too, is that if you don't get feedback, that is a huge problem. Feedback is the way that you get better and better at your job, and it's the way that you get better assignments and potentially get raises and promotions and build your reputation. If your boss is never giving you critical feedback, you're forfeiting all of those things. So you've got to get yourself into a mindset where even if it's hard to hear, ultimately you're seeing it as a good thing.
And your reaction if you don't agree with the feedback, Rob, should be what?
Well, it's first important, I guess, to take some time to consider.
not just to respond in the moment, you're saying? Okay.
Because I think we had that caller earlier who, you know, showed the value of sort of self-reflection and stepping back and viewing a situation and seeing how her own, you know, sort of background was playing into a particular situation. And that helped her solve that situation much more effectively than if she had just stayed focused on, you know, my boss is a jerk or whatever. So I think it's important to try to step back, take a deep breath, and as Allison is saying, you know, try to figure out why you're being perceived that way. And that's the beginning of your crafting whatever response it is that you're going to have. And you want to try to, you know, you want to try to remain in the realm of, you know, logic and fact rather than just emotion and feeling hurt and lashing out and saying, well, actually, you're a terrible boss. And that's the real problem, you know, because you don't get to take those things back. So it's good to give some thoughtfulness to the reply.
And Allison, one more variation on this. If this is your first or second job, starting a new career, new graduate or something, talk a little bit about how you take that in and experience something that you've never experienced before. Those of us in, you know, mid careers, well, we've had experiences with this. What do you do as a new employee?
I think it's especially important to remember as a new employee, you have a lot of learning that you're going to be doing in the next however many years over the course of your career. You presumably picture yourself 5 years from now being more advanced in your career than you are today.
Okay.
The way that you get there is by getting feedback along the way. And so whoever takes the time to sit down with you and gives you some critique, that's huge. That person is helping you walk that path that you need to get to your future jobs. So I think I hear from a lot of people who were sort of the golden child in school. They always did really well. They easily got good grades. School was never hard for them. And then they get to work and it's harder and they're getting critical feedback and they haven't built up that muscle previously for how you deal with that. And it can be really discouraging. So I think going into work knowing that it is a different environment than you've been in academically, that you will be told, oh, actually, we don't want you to do it that way. We want you to do it this way instead. That is just a normal part of the process and it's not something to panic over.
That's good. Drew tweets in, great show topic. I was released from my prior position back in February. I was wondering if I should prioritize a position description to gain further experience or a location I see myself investing in long term. Drew says, I have 2 years experience and master's degree. Thanks. Rob, do you get the question there?
Well, I mean, it sounds like a sort of prioritizing what the next, you know, what to prioritize in the job search,
yes.
Experience versus location. It's a life crossroads kind of thing, and maybe the thing to do is to pursue a little bit of both and see which direction is starting to feel more promising and more exciting to you. I mean, if you know you're going – if I have had questions from people who are sort of like, well, I live in XYZ city and I really don't want to live here anymore. And my advice is like, well, if you're really unhappy in a place, then you should make your priority getting out of that place.
Right.
If it's more ambiguous, then, yeah, you know, I mean, there's not going to be a set answer to this. It's going to be a sort of a trade-off of the more experience and skill set you build up, the more options you'll have to move on. But that's going to continue to be true forever. So at some point, you have to just kind of do enough exploring to make a hard decision based on something tangible rather than on something abstract.
John called to ask, how long do I have to stay at a new job I don't like before I start looking for something else? Allison, is there any set time limit?
There's this strange myth out there that you just have to put in a year and then you're good. And People put way too much weight on that. If you're really miserable and the job is not the right fit for you, you do not have to put in a year before you're allowed to leave. The thing to realize is that it's the overall pattern that matters. So if you have a bunch of very short-term stays, that's going to look alarming to prospective employers. They're going to think that you job hop, that you won't stay with them very long. But one short-term stay, that's, you get a freebie. You get a pass on that. You can have a short-term stay. It's just when it starts, when they start piling up, that it's an issue.
And when you're in the interview for the next job and they ask about what your tenure was and you say, well, it was actually 6 months, are you saying things like, and I learned something about myself from this job? You know, I mean, how are you spinning it?
Yeah, so it depends on what really happened. If it was, for example, I signed up for a job doing X and it turned out to be Y instead, that's very understandable. You can be very straightforward about that. If it's a little trickier to explain, if it's like, oh, I hated the boss, or I just found it really boring, you have to spin it a little bit. But you don't have to come up with a lie. I mean, you can say, if the issue is that it was really boring, I like to be kept busy all the time. I'm looking for something that's faster paced. I know myself well enough to know that where I really thrive is when I'm busy all the time. So you just have to put kind of a positive sheen on it.
If you've just gotten on the show, Rob Walker with us and Allison Green taking your calls and questions about workplace, I guess I'm saying, dramas and dilemmas and big picture questions about work, how to negotiate a raise, how to manage up to the boss. We haven't talked about that yet, but let's get to it. And other questions, 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. I recently had a conversation with a colleague who is in this field in a different city, and she feels stuck between, I'm never going to love any other job like I love this, but they don't know my value, and I'm not sure they ever are going to know my value. And I gave some advice, but given that we were talking about this, I thought I'd put this to you and Rob. What kind of advice would you give this friend?
Well, first, I would want to know what she's done about it so far. Has she gone to her employer and made a pitch for recognize her value? I assume that means money. So has she gone and asked for a raise? If she has and she's been turned down and she's asked, what would I need to do to get it in the future? And there's no real clear answer. And she feels like maybe she never will get one in the future. Then at that point, she needs to decide, is her love of that job worth it to her to continue staying knowing that she feels underpaid? Or does she want to take a gamble of moving somewhere that does pay her what she thinks she's worth, knowing she might not love it as much as she loves this one? It's mm-hmm. hard. There's not an easy answer there.
Rob?
I do want to say, in this situation, a lot of people advise going out and getting an offer and taking it back to your employer
right.
and seeing if they'll make a counteroffer. There are some fields that work that way, where that is how people do it. I don't recommend it for most people in most fields, because there's a good chance they'll call your bluff and say, okay, we can't match that. Go ahead and take it. But even if they do match it, now you're somewhere where you had to be threatening to walk out the door in order to be paid what you're worth. It's possible that in a year when you ask for a raise, they're going to say, no, we already gave you that big raise last year. And there are also some employers who get really weird when people do that, who now feel like you're disloyal. And if the time comes when they have to, say, make cuts, you're going to be on the top of that list.
Yeah. You know, Rob, I was going to ask you about a version of what Allison just said, as in, I am 100% committed here. But, you know, we're in a situation where I feel that I should look around, you know, that kind of thing. And not making that a bluff, making that a real thing. What do you say about that tactic?
Yeah, well, I agree that you should never go shopping for an offer just as a pure tactic. You should be ready to go, which is a very different thing. And, you know, to go back to your friend, it's kind of relevant, because this question of what she means by being valued is kind of the core to it, because maybe it's just more money, but maybe it's something else. And that might be something that she needs to kind of, you know, fight through and figure out what is the nature of the kind of reward that she is truly seeking. And that's going to guide everything. And that may lead to, well, I'm going to look for some other jobs and see if there's something out there that feels like it might be fulfilling, not as a bluff, but as an exploration, and to figure out if maybe the best path is a path out.
I do think value for this friend is more than just money, but money's a pretty big part of it. So, hey, thanks for the advice. To Samantha in Minneapolis. Hi, Samantha. What's your question?
Hello. Well, first I'd like to say long-time listener, first-time caller, really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
I am going for my laboratory certification, and I'm starting in August. I plan it'll take a year, year and a half, and I want to move to Hawaii.
Ah, can I move with you? That sounds great.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I want to know what's the best way to do that logistically. Like, do you go out there for a couple of weeks and job interview? I mean, yeah, how do you choose an apartment? How to prioritize that?
Relocating, Rob. What's the best method, would you say?
Yeah, it depends a little bit on your specifics in terms of, but I think what you just outlined is sort of perfectly reasonable, and you might lead into it by starting to spend a lot. Luckily, it's sort of easier to do this now than it was when I was first getting onto the job market, because you have the internet at your disposal, so you can start really exploring a lot just from wherever you are to help. But I do think showing up and scoping out a place for a little bit is helpful. Try to meet as many people as you can. Try to interview. You're going to have to probably, you know, in real life, you're going to probably have to try to improvise. I think, you know, it'll depend on, like, if you actually get an offer and someone's trying to, you know, how serious are you about moving? How quickly can you do it? It's going to be tough to predict that stuff. But I think that you're on the right path and that you're thinking about it in the right way. And I think you should kind of maybe prepare a couple of alternate scenarios depending on what resources you have available. To see if you could get hired before moving, or if that's not working out, to just go ahead and bite the bullet and make the move.
Make the move.
By the time you do that, you would want to have a pretty clear picture of what the job market is there, and which, unfortunately, I'm unable to help you with the details of the Hawaiian job market.
But, even though you'd like to know that.
Do your homework there. Yeah.
Allison, any additional advice on that?
Yeah, depending on your field, it can be harder to get hired long distance. It can be easier if you present it as, I am moving to Hawaii, I will be moving there by August 31st or mm-hmm. whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So it's a done deal. They're more likely to take a chance on you if you say that. So even just putting on your resume, like underneath the address field in your resume, put in parentheses, relocating to Hawaii by August 31st. Mention it in your cover letter. If you're going to be there for a couple of weeks, so you'll be available for interviews, put those dates in your cover letter so they know. Minimize the inconvenience to them of you being a long distance candidate, and that can go a long way.
That's good. Arnold called to say, I'm in a situation where my boss is asking me to do the work of a large team of people. I like my job, but I just want to lessen the workload. Is it possible to negotiate this somehow? Allison, this is good. Where maybe you're in a job and you just think, I don't want to be seen as a slacker, but I want to do the work well, and I feel like I'm overloaded. How do you talk about that with a boss?
Yeah, sit down with your boss and lay out everything that you're doing. And if there's impact on the work because of the workload, like if certain things are getting pushed back or delayed or you're never getting to them at all, run through all of that and then say, in a reasonable amount of hours a week, which we agree is X number of hours a week, hopefully it's 40, in some fields it will be more, here's what I could get done. And here's what that means. Here's the pile of stuff that is not getting done in that amount of time. Can we talk about how to prioritize that and to make sure that I'm making the right trade-offs? Because otherwise, you're either working unreasonable hours for an unsustainable amount of time, or some of those things aren't going to get done anyway, and those things will be chosen by default. If you present it that way, your boss probably does not want the undone things to be on a whim.
That's
he
good.
Or she probably wants to pick them deliberately.
Right. Rob, I've got about a minute left, but as I said, we're in graduate season. What's the best advice you'd give a new grad launching a career?
Oh, boy. The advice I often end up giving to young people is try to be patient.
Why?
That you may not get the immediate dream job, you know, right off the bat. And second, as a little bit longer term thing, you know, we talk a lot about how to manage up. And I'm a big fan of, like, from the minute you get into the workforce and from that moment on, to be very respectful of your peers. And even as you move through the situation, those below you, because you never know who is going to end up being your potential boss someday, which is a lesson that I think a lot of young people end up learning the hard way. And so focus on your peers a lot at the beginning and be patient.
Okay. Hey, really good to talk with you both. Thanks so much for spending the hour to launch the series with us. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
Rob, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Rob Walker writes the Workologist column for the New York Times. Allison Green runs the AskAManager.org website, and they'll both take your work questions. I'm also interested in suggestions for shows for this series. You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.